Hello, friends. This is the beginning of the Angel of the Presence commentaries, number 2. Okay, BGN. Of the Angel of the Presence commentaries 2. And it's Esoteric Psychology 2, page 44 in the first commentary. It was rather a general approach to the meaning of the Angel of the Presence, of the Solar Angel, of the ego in several different modes, and of the general fluid relationship between them, such that it becomes difficult to discriminate really what is what. But when we contact our own ego on the higher mental plane within the egoic body, we are in fact contacting that part of the solar angel which is invested in our egoic structure, in our causal body. So even though it is a vehicle, a kind of periodic vehicle, and a heart center of the monad, it is also the presence of the being and consciousness of the solar angel, who, having pervaded the entire universe of the causal body with a fragment of itself, remains and to which we begin to respond as we develop egoic consciousness. So I've explained all that as best I can for the moment. Could be better tomorrow, who knows. In the first commentary. And now we're going to actually begin working in the book. There's only 5 pages here, but it will take a little while because it goes very deep. My hope and my intention is to offer some commentary on various sections of Esoteric Psychology 2, from which book we have taught in the University of the Seven Rays for a long time, beginning back in 1988, 25 years ago. And some of the members of that group are still around and still associated with our work. So it might be a way of condensing much of what was said at that time, because so much of it at that time was not recorded. And maybe we can, since it is a subject of great interest to all of our students and to each one of us on the faculty, it would be good to condense and the response to those pages and to focus them clearly. Maybe also some work in the light of the on the laws of the soul, which I did already in a sense in the last pages of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and also from Esoteric Psychology 1 some of the introductory material concerning the rays. I think very important, including stanzas and ray names, which have often been taught but maybe not preserved in any codified way that can be studied by others over time. That's my purpose. So here from the rays and the initiations. No, the rays and initiation. Okay, it's not the book, the rays and the initiations. It will not be possible for me to make clear the ray reactions to the final process, which we have considered briefly, namely the stage of liberation of the spirit, which we call identification. Well, where have we considered this? We can say just recently considered when speaking of the Blessed Ones. Because there we have the entire pilgrimage of the monad beginning as a going forth into the 5 lower worlds and returning in a great homecoming where the fullness of identification as far as the monad can appreciate it at its present state of immersion is understood. So perhaps this identificatory process is really beginning as we approach the third degree. I think between the second and third degree much is possible, but really our first conscious contact with the monad is occurring at the third degree, and with it the beginning of the path, the real path of identification. It's the path of initiation and also leading to the path of identification, which comes into its own right later as we are going through the still higher initiations. And who is really going through these initiations? You know, it's not us as individuals. The One is being initiated in all of its emanations. There are, well, however many emanations of the One there are, they reach a point of retraction which we call initiation, and a still further point of retraction which we call identification. And by retraction, I don't mean that they cannot be, that these emanations can still not be involved in the lower worlds. I simply mean that there is a rising in consciousness along the line of emanative descent, and a realization increasingly of what the source of the emanation which one realizes oneself to be really is. Okay, so all that is possible, even in the case of initiation which we are going to discuss now, is to give the elementary stanzas which convey to accepted disciples some of the significance of the first initiation, and by this I want to say the first real initiation. Though we did learn earlier that even at the first initiation, at the second, something of the angel of the presence is sensed, is seen, but only a partial revelation. And what the stanzas we're going to deal with now deal, in fact, with a kind of merging of the angel with its disciple personality. And this merging may be considered complete at the fourth degree, but happens to such an extent at the third degree that there's a kind of a 75% of merging, we might say. And the ancient authority of the personality is ended at this point, and the One who is in command is the angel of the presence with whom the soul in incarnation now identifies. Okay, so all that is possible, even in the case of initiation, is to give the elementary stanzas which convey to accepted disciples some of the significance of the first initiation. And by that, we will mean the third initiation especially. As regards identification, the reactions of the illumined initiate are made available to his intelligence in symbolic form. And the illumined initiate is, you know, the, let's call it the self-realizing Blessed One, are made available to his intelligence in symbolic form, but if these forms were described, they would be completely misunderstood. So we will not be given these symbolic forms, but they do exist. And we are told, actually, that the conveying of symbols is a very important part of the higher initiations, which are taken either singly by the initiate or in small groups. So there will be identificatory symbols, I think. There are identificatory symbols. But they will not be here given. But if these forms were given, they would be completely misunderstood. When the third initiation takes place and the wider door looms before the initiate, it's quite a paradox that the requirements get increasingly strict and straight and in a way narrow, but the door is wider into broader, wider life. And always identification with the whole. As it says in the sixth-ray stanza, the whole is with us now. Where has it been before? Okay. The door opens widely into identification with the whole and as the whole. When the third initiation takes place and the wider door, open door looms before the initiate, he will then discover the meaning of that type of realization, which is here called, for lack of a better name, identification. And if I'm remembering properly here, we have realization plus esoteric experience plus absorption into the whole. This is how DK at one point describes identification, and we could ponder on each one of these phrases. It seems to be the very thing which is so needed, all the way from its lower expressions where we identify in empathy with another and realize our unity with the other, which is a soul-inspired type of realization, all the way to the progressive realizations of the One. I don't think for a minute that the first realization of the One is the final realization of the One. I believe they are progressive until we reach identification as the universal logos itself, and then truly have complete identification as the One, which is a destined eventuality, which will not occur until the end of this particular universe, ending phases, let's be safe about it, of this particular universe, and not necessarily on the cosmic physical plane at all, but on the highest levels of the universe, where whence we will be retracted, monadically retracted, and who knows how high those planes go. Supercosmic is not enough, and we're only given maps of cosmic planes, and super-supercosmic is not enough, and super-super-supercosmic is not enough. What is meant by the 10 dimensions of cosmos? This has to be understood. Ray 1. I'll read it first, and then I'll try to offer some thought associations which may help us get closer to the true meaning of this phrase, this stanza concerning the merging of the first ray soul with its personality, with its already partially infused personality, because there's been infusion at the first degree and second degree. I'm assuming here, though, now that we are dealing with the third degree. The angel of the presence stands within the light divine, the center and the meeting place of many forces. These forces meet and blend. They focus in the head of him who stands before the angel. Eye to eye, face to face, hand to hand, they stand. Will reinforces will, and love meets love. The will to power merges with the will to love, and strength with wisdom meets. These two are one. From that high spot of unity, the one who is released stands forth and says, I return from whence I came. From the formless to the world of form I make my way. I will to be, I will to work, I will to serve and save. I will to lift the race. I serve the plan with will, the whole with power. In every one of these stanzas, you're going to find a statement regarding the plan associated and followed immediately or almost immediately by a statement relating to the whole. Unless there is an appreciation of what wholeness is, at least in terms of our planetary context, there will be no appreciation of what the plan is. So with the angel of the presence, we are going to talk about that part of the solar angel invested in the egoic structure, really responsible for making and sustaining the egoic structure, and that part which meets the rising monadic extension, the rising blessed one, we can say, in the causal body, and makes it possible for the presence to be appreciated within the causal body, though not wholly appreciated later until the causal body is destroyed. So stands within the light divine. Here we have the first aspect, interestingly associated with light, but I can say, let's see, I want to make sure that I have my bracket. I probably do, but if I don't, it means I have to turn off the whole program and start again. So the light divine, if it's light divine, divine comes from the jewel in the lotus, which receives it from the point of divinity, which is the monad itself. So let's just say for the moment we are speaking of the stance of the angel of the presence on the higher mental plane. Now, on what level? That's difficult to say, because interestingly, the jewel in the lotus, a technical point, is said to be positioned, as it were, between the highest part of the higher mental plane and the lowest part of the Buddhic plane. What exactly that means, we cannot say, but it seems to be a kind of transitional structure. This seems to be the place where the emanation from the monad is first anchored as the central fire and as what will be revealed as the jewel in the lotus, representing, I suppose, a sevenfold aspect of the monad, which is also a 12-fold structure, as far as I can understand. There's so much about the monad, the higher 12, maybe it's the vehicle of the monad, and maybe its own jewel is sevenfold. The number 19 emerges, and we can probably find our way to the number 22 pretty easily from there. So there is a stance upon the higher mental plane. There is divine light, the light of the jewel. It's a radiant light. I'm reminded of the light of Vulcan. Reminded of the light of Vulcan, which, in my view, blinded Saint Paul. And it was not Venus that caused the blindness. It was the great release of jewel in the lotus light from Vulcan. And so stands within the light divine. Is he standing within the jewel in the lotus here? Perhaps that is his anchor point. There are many different solar angels who seem to be emanations of the one solar angel. And these many solar angels have they're almost like a hierarchy in themselves. They have a place within the different tiers of the egoic lotus, the different circles, and also lesser ones of them have a place within the individual petals. So the solar angel in emanation is a kind of a multiple being, just the way our personality is a group being in a sense. There is the each one of the elementals of the vehicles in hierarchical order in a way, plus the still greater elemental, which is a kind of fusion of the three of them, called the personality elemental. So we're dealing with group beings. See, I'm not claiming to understand the ins and outs of emanation theory. I just feel deeply that it is of vital importance in understanding relationships within cosmos. I don't know if I was one of those old Gnostics or something for whom emanation was so important. I mean, I feel a connection with the Gnostics and with the Neoplatonists. I kind of wonder, it is put forward by one theorist that Master D.K. was a great Neoplatonist by the name of Plotinus, or Plotinus. I'm not sure how it would be pronounced in the Greek. There are three great Neoplatonists, Plotinus, Proclus, and Iamblichus. Iamblichus is said to be the now master Hilarion. I'm not sure about Proclus. But anyway, they are an outstanding group in those early centuries A.D., and I think Plotinus came first. And the Neoplatonic thought was a revival of the kinds of esoteric thought in Greece occurring some 7 or 8 centuries earlier in the times of Pythagoras and Plato. So anyway, many forces, we're reminded here of the law of assembly in Shambhala, by means of which, all the energies which are to be used within our planetary focus are brought together and received to be lawfully administered under cyclic law for the growth and progress of the planet. And maybe, you know, a Shambhala. Where is Shambhala? How many Shambhalas are there? Is there one pertaining to our globe and to other globes? Are there chain Shambhalas? Are they reflective of maybe one planetary logoic Shambhala, the highest of them all and the most inclusive of them all? Again, we have emanation theory to deal with if we're going to understand the many and the one. For the solar angel, for Shambhala, and for the Buddhas of activity, emanation theory is all required. So we have many forces, and you know, the first ray type is the powerful wielder of forces. So we think of the Shambhala force and its focused application as a power that touches and then withdraws. And here the first ray type has many forces in his hands to be cyclically released in power. Forces to be cyclically released in power at the right time. So, you know, first ray controls beginnings and endings, birth and death, we might say, when a thing appears and when it is compelled to disappear. So all of these forces come together in the hand of this particular angel. Now, look, we don't know whether it is angels of a certain kind who are assigned to human beings of a certain kind or to monads of a certain kind. Obviously, they are pretty much involved with the soul ray rather than the monadic ray, but the soul ray can change. And I don't think we have a change of angels when the soul ray changes. Maybe we have the capacity in the angel of the presence to focus itself on any particular ray. Who knows what is the reason and the mode for the assignment of various human monads to their supervising solar angels, who express as angels of the presence. So these forces, the many of them, meet and blend. There's a lot of this, you know, meet and merge, merge and blend, meet and blend. These are the kinds of phrases DK uses to discuss the language of energy on these high levels. These forces meet and blend, and that is in the presence of the angel of the presence, I would say, in the presence of the angel of the presence. They focus in the head of him who stands before the angel, and always the first ray has to do with the head center. The head center, it is a first ray center, whether it would be ruled by Pluto initially, first ray Pluto, or Vulcan later, first ray Vulcan, or maybe even at a certain point Uranus, I would say, first ray monadic Uranus. It's always a first ray center, and the head as a whole is a great directing structure. or center of force, which is occultly responsible for the management of the rest of the body. We sometimes say, well, it's all in the heart center, but we have to remember that within the head center is the higher prototype of the heart center. So even the heart exists within the head. There is an entire kind of macrocosm in the head, which stands for the rest of the body, even a base of the spine center in the head, which we can associate with the alta major center, sort of at the base of the skull. So these forces meet and blend. They focus in the head of him. Now, who stands before the angel? Let's just say the becoming initiate stands before the angel. Now, how much of the inner apparatus or the energy system is taken into the chamber of initiation? Do we take our etheric nature, our astral nature, and our lower mental nature into that chamber? Obviously not our physical body. How many of our principles are taken there? And do we, as human beings, have a quasi-human human form when we stand before the angel? Because we, as it tells us here, that we stand, let's see, how does it go here? Here it is. A radiant angelic existence seen with the inner eye with the same accuracy of vision and judgment as when a man stands face to face with another member of the human family. The great solar angel who embodies the real man, and the word embodies is kind of interesting because he provides a body for the real man, the monad, on the higher mental plane. So there is a very sophisticated use of words which has to be analyzed closely. The solar angel providing body for the real man, the monad, on the higher mental plane, and is his expression on the plane of mind, the way the monad expresses itself. The attenuated monad on the plane of mind is literally his divine ancestor, the watcher who through long cycles of incarnation has poured himself out in sacrifice in order that man, as man I would add, might be. Sometimes in coming back to initiation, human and solar, one gains a clearer idea of what the solar angel and angel of the presence really are. After all the complexities introduced in the other books, the return to this book is clarifying and consolidating, though enriched, of course, by all that has been read elsewhere. So he also can stand as the sphere of radiant fire, but the whole idea is that there is a there's an emanation of energy from the heart center of the solar angel, who presumably has chakras, and if Sanat Kumara can have a quasi-human form, then why can the solar angel not have a quasi-human form? Sometimes you look at the renderings of the angels as presented by Hodson and whatever artists he worked with, and we see that they, while not looking exactly like a human being, have a kind of a chakric system, and they have a head and a heart and so forth. When we think about the violet devas on the systemic etheric planes, they carry crescent moons in their forehead. Well, if they have a forehead, they've got a head. So they have a quasi-human form, though probably, you know, much less concrete and more fluid and so forth. But still, on our particular planet, this form that the human being takes seems to have its higher and more ethereal correspondences on the higher planes. Okay. Now it tells me that I've lost my audio connection. Okay.